Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Sian Kane.
And me, Richard Lee.
Bret Easton Ellis joins us to lift the lid on the controversy around White, his first book in 10 years, which appears to have upset a very particular demographic.
Yeah, I am very sympathetic to millennials and as well as frustrated by them and annoyed. You can be both.
Plus, we discuss the new poet laureate. The news was mysteriously delayed for weeks on end and theories abound as to why. But finally, last Friday, it was announced that Simon Armitage will be following in the footsteps of John Dryden, William Wordsworth, Ted Hughes, and, of course, most recently, Carol Ann Duffy as the UK's national poet. But first, we'll be talking to that poster boy for bad behaviour, Bret Easton Ellis. Since blowing up the literary world with his grisly serial killer novel American Psycho, which I think has the distinction of being one of the only novels you have failed to finish, Sian,
yeah,
is that right?
That's exactly right.
It comes shrink-wrapped, doesn't it, in some countries?
Yeah, it comes shrink-wrapped in South Australia, where I'm from, and I used to have to card people when they came to buy it at the bookshop I worked in. It was quite a weird thing. It's like buying booze or porn or Bret Easton Ellis.
Well, he's now turned to non-fiction with a new essay collection called White, but he still can't keep away from controversy, having spent the last few weeks laying into millennials, in the interest, of course, of promoting his book. His work demands readers with hard heads as well as hard stomachs. He's not just the shock jock that the headlines might suggest. So we called in our arts editor, Alex Needham, to find out what makes the time bomb tick. Sian, you were there. What's he like as a person? He talks about people being over-triggered. Were you over-triggered?
Well, there was this funny moment when I went to collect him before the interview, and he looked at me and sort of just, you could just kind of tell that he was anticipating some sort of reaction because of my age.
Of what you looked like.
I'm an awful millennial and I've come to collect him for his interview, and I don't think he knew who Alex was, so maybe he thought I was Alex and he was just sort of like, oh no, some 28-year-old's about to just lay into me for the next 45
minutes. I've been set up, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But I just sat quietly in the corner and listened in on the interview. Just because I was interested, he'd been in the news so much recently. And of course, I have quite a fraught relationship with a lot of his writing, in that I think he's an immensely talented guy, but he's sort of settled for getting reactions out of people by shocking them.
He's very, very talented, but he is also a sort of proper formalist, isn't he? He takes a very craftsmanlike
work. He's got a real sense of style that you can immediately recognise his writing. It's not just sort of gore, 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 which is sort of what you might think of if you hadn't read American Psycho and then were trying to sort of base an opinion on it. It's always the gore what people talk about. But actually, he's got an incredible sense of style. And I think Less Than Zero is an amazing book. But then to sort of have him over the last few weeks promoting this essay collection, White, and having him just immediately sort of going for all the topics that everyone wants him to talk about, you know, the Trump, the millennials being, you know, fatuous and awful and all this sort of stuff. But the funny thing is, even though I've got all these ideas about the kind of writer that he is, White was actually a far more surprising book than I thought it would be.
So let's hear him talking to Alex.
So you've written White, which is your first book for 10 years. And like most of your books, it's caused a massive reaction. There's a furious backlash, and now there actually seems to be a backlash to the backlash. Why do you think that? Do you ever set out to be controversial, or is it just something that happens?
No. You can't suss out to be controversial, because what if it doesn't work? What have you done then? I mean, you can't, I mean, look, I've been around more or less for 35 years. You can't really sustain a career on just shocking people or being provocative. And that is not where I start from. That's not a place I start from as a writer. I have things that I'm interested in writing about for very personal reasons. They mean a lot to me. But I'm not thinking of an audience. I'm not thinking of an audience when I write things down, when I put together a book like White or any of the fiction that I've written. So I don't know why the books trigger people in the way they do. And I must say, they don't trigger some people. Some people are perfectly happy with White and really like it. And they're not triggered by it, and they don't think it's a, you know, this terrible manifesto or whatever people on the negative side of things seem to consider the book. But I just don't know if that's like an honest place you can start from as a writer. And I also, I'm not necessarily interested in that much attention. I have not published a book for 10 years. Obviously, if I was looking for more attention, I would have published a book every 2 years or so, and maybe written the sequel to American Psycho, or maybe written something of some kind of obvious shock value. And it just doesn't work that way for me.
I think it's interesting in the book where you talk about giving your partner at the time the manuscript to American Psycho, which I think you were writing.
Yes.
And then you were very surprised when he said, oh, this is going to get you in so much trouble.
Yes, I was. And that's why I wrote about this in White. I didn't believe him. Right. I foolishly didn't believe him. I didn't believe good old Jim, who looked at some of these pages late in the game. I mean, I was finishing that book up in 1989, and that's when that scene took place. I'd been living with him for about a year. I had shown American Psycho to nobody. Nobody had seen it. I was the only one. I was the only one privy to it. I didn't show parts of it to friends or get people's opinions on it. And since I was living with Jim, he wanted to read it, and he was reading it. And that scene that I describe in White happened, where he said, you're going to get into trouble. I said, what are you talking about? You know, this is, I really had come to the point where I believed that this was a severely uncommercial novel that was kind of like an experimental novel. I loved writing it. It was fascinating to write for 3 years, but I also thought 10, 15,000 readers tops.
Right.
If
so
that.
You, so
I didn't think there was anybody.
Would really care.
And then I thought, I'm going to have my million selling book will be the next one, Glamorama.
Right.
That will be the big one. That will connect with the audience in a giant way. So you never know. You don't, you know. And so Jim was right. Yes, I got into a lot of trouble because of the book. I didn't think he was right. And I think in retrospect, when we see the book, and we read it now, that it's many more things than just what the controversy suggested in 1990, 1991, if I do say so myself.
I mean, there's a sort of a bit, it's a bit of a theme in White about how you're surprised by people's reactions. And I'm just wondering whether there is something a little disingenuous where you say something rude on Twitter about Kathryn Bigelow, for instance,
yep.
and then you get an angry response. And you seem quite taken aback by that.
Twitter and the novel are two very different things.
Yes.
Twitter was a way to get responses from people. Not particular people, but it was a way to read the audience. And often many, many people were on your side going, yeah, right on, I agree with you about that. And then there was the side that clutched their pearls and was shocked and couldn't believe you said that. I have never been shocked by a tweet in my life. So it's hard for me to understand how someone is shocked by my tweets. Twitter, as I write in the book, I never considered it to be like a real thing. It was an app that was fun to use. And in the early days, it was an app that was used to incite people and have outrageous opinions and say, but for 2 minutes, for 1 or 2 minutes, for 5 minutes. It didn't seem to have the kind of longevity that I guess it does today with certain tweets. I don't remember then that tweets were getting 147,000 likes or dislikes. It was kind of like the Wild West. And it wasn't supposed to be taken so seriously. So when I would tweet certain outrageous things, it was like fun for 5 minutes. And then it seemed to me to be a very disposable thing. And that was it. It was kind of in that moment. If you're talking about like a long-term idea of provoking people and shocking people, I don't know. I guess I can't relate to it because I don't think I've ever been felt that way about art. And I talk about that. I've never been shocked or I can't believe that I'm reading this. I've wanted to be torn apart by art. I've wanted art to upset me. But to be offended by art or to be offended by a tweet, I'm not there. And I don't understand how anybody else is either.
Right. Because being disturbed is an important response, isn't it? As a
yeah.
I don't want to say consumer, as a reader,
as a viewer, as a person, as someone who grows up in this terrible world. Yes, you need to confront that, and you need to experience it. And it's not going to kill you. You know, it's not going to wreck you. And you don't. I mean, I guess now people are triggered, and they need warnings about stuff. But I love that part of growing up. I love coming across art that shook me and that upset me and that made me see the world in a different way. But offended? I don't think I've ever been offended by a piece of art, and certainly I've never been offended by a tweet. That, to me, is the height of ridiculousness. But there you go.
I'm quite interested in your idea in the book about sort of empire and post-empire, which you sort of suggest that the turn in culture happens or is exemplified by someone like Eminem, who he kind of appears, doesn't he, in like 99, so I suppose it's 2 years before, yes, 9/11, which seems to be your marker between empire and post-empire. Can you talk a little bit about this divide and where we are culturally?
It's my own personal theory. It's my own little personal theory. You're not going to find this in any history books. This is not written about culturally anywhere. Gore Vidal called the U.S., officially an empire after the war.
Right.
It was the most powerful country in the world. And like all empires, he said, it's going to fall at one point. When is it going to fall? And to me, I felt a shift was happening in terms of what I call empire propriety. This notion that if you were well-known, you played by the rules of humble, earnest celebrity, to a degree. Mm. And that's what everyone expected, and that empire was about making yourself look the best you possibly could. And there seemed to be some shift after 9/11 and into the Obama presidency where I noticed this shift where people really weren't adhering to that anymore. And people were shucking off the bounds of empire propriety, whether it was John Mayer gave this incendiary interview in Playboy that shocked a lot of people.
My dick is a white supremacist was one of the quotes.
Well, there was. And then also his sexual life was also a big part of it, too, that he would have been so obviously blatant about his sexual life. And it was people getting impatient with empire propriety. And you could see that with someone as innocuous as Ricky Gervais on the Golden Globe or Lady Gaga on 60 Minutes. This is like daring people to say something about her that when she says she smokes weed during when she writes songs, which a lot of people were not admitting in the mainstream media then 10 years ago. And it was. Eminem was that first poster boy. Those records came out in the late 90s. But they were a kind of, it seemed like a response to something like, if he's writing a record about the failure of his marriage, like Bruce Springsteen did with Tunnel of Love and like Bob Dylan did with Blood on the Tracks, this was a very different kind of expression at play. It wasn't polished. It wasn't tasteful. It wasn't necessarily even that tuneful. It was a transparent howl of rage. Mm. And he did not neuter his fantasies. I mean, he has a song there where he murders his wife and she's shrieking, you know, by his own hands. And all of this seemed to be heading towards something. I think Charlie Sheen's breakdown in that moment when he was fired from Two and a Half Men. And he just said, fuck you to everybody. And this is who I am. Take it or leave it. I'm not going to play by these rules anymore. To be a key moment in this post-empire period that we briefly went through for 4 or 5 years before something clamped down on it and didn't want it to flourish anymore. I thought it was a fascinating 5 years. I thought something like Kanye West grabbing Taylor Swift's award away from her at the MTV Music Awards seemed like that kind of moment. A lot of Kanye moments did. And then it seemed that corporate culture began to write the new rules, and then everyone started to conform to this, and that there was a new kind of propriety had been instilled.
But I mean, in a way, this propriety is not that rampant, is it? You know, we've got Trump who has got
a post-empire president.
Yeah.
A post-empire president, yeah.
Yeah. So what you kind of say about a sort of sense of propriety, which you do describe as fascism, if I've got that right, quite a few times in the book.
Yeah.
Dramatic, it's not really, there's quite a big, to me, that's not the dominant discourse is. I mean, it is in certain pockets of places, but generally, you know, people are exposing themselves all over the internet. You have Trump, who sort of has told 10,000 lies in his presidency, yes. and attacks anyone who's slighted him, you know, incredibly full bore.
Yeah.
You've got this ongoing chaotic sense here in the UK with all the discourse around Brexit. When did this moment ever
end? I'm talking
ever
about
end?
Culture.
Right, okay.
I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about people in the entertainment business which is what I write about.
Yeah,
in
white. Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't writing about outside the culture and business or in politics. It was specifically entertainers, creatives, expressing themselves in ways that I had never seen before.
Right.
And expressing themselves in public without any PR niceties. And that was the interesting moment for me that was post-Empire. And when I write about it in the book, it's all about entertainers. It's all about musicians. It's all about actors. It's all about that moment where it seemed you could be a creative and totally free in what you said and how you expressed yourself. And there was a clamping down on that. Entertainers all the time are self-censoring now. Entertainers all the time are afraid to say certain things, are afraid to express themselves fully in that way that it seemed to be flowering in that moment. But certainly in the dominant culture, with everyone shrieking at each other and saying whatever they want to say to each other, is different than I think what's going on within the entertainment system and what it means to be an artist.
Right. And you think that they're scared to say what they really think because they'll get monstered on Twitter? Is it that kind of thing?
I think that's partly it. That's partly the mob, being afraid of the mob. But you can also just stay off Twitter. You know, you don't have to, you know, I remember talking to Quentin Tarantino about a really terrible week he had in 2015 where he'd given some interviews and then everybody called him racist. He was totally racist for this or that. And he said some sexist stuff. He didn't like Kate Blanchett, he said in an interview. I don't like her as an actress. And all hell broke loose. And I had him on my podcast and I said to him, this has been a really bad week. I mean, everyone's calling you this and calling you that. And he said, I don't know anything about any of this. What do you mean?
Right.
He said, well, he said, I don't go on social media. Mm. I haven't heard about this, and I'm sure it will just evaporate and that it will pass, which it ultimately does. But I think that it is tied into the cult of likability, and it is tied into wanting more followers, more people on Instagram to like your post. And there is a kind of performative aspect to people's lives now that say, love me, like me, I'm aspirational. I'm an aspirational figure. I'm ascending to something. And again, I'm talking within the entertainment and I'm talking about within cultural circles. And I think that's, I don't know, it is what it is. I mean, I find it interesting, but it might not be for others.
Although I'm kind of wondering now about people like XXXTentacion, you know, those sort of SoundCloud rappers who were probably, you know, who make Eminem look like
completely
sort of Mary Poppins.
Yes.
You know, and they're hugely
yes.
popular.
Yes.
But maybe they're not quite in the mainstream discourse.
No, they're not in the mainstream in that way. So I guess those aren't what I'm talking about. But there is an extreme thing going on the edges of the culture. And I think there will always be. I was talking to the CEO of Miramax, and we were talking about the fact that Disney is basically going to be the only corporation in town dealing with content and making content. And I was asking, well, what does this mean? So everything's going to be the PG-13 rating that we have in the States. Does this mean no more nudity in movies? Does this mean no more smoking in movies? I mean, does this mean a real watering down of content if Disney is going to be the only thing, the company that controls all the content that's being made? And he said, no, not necessarily. There's always going to be a hunger for kind of violent, dark stuff, and that will always be produced somehow. And to think that Disney is going to somehow wave its wand and make everything Disneyfied is probably alarmist. And there will always be a hunger for that from people. It's just not going to be in the mainstream anymore. They're not going to have that kind of anarchic art that used to appear in the mainstream every so often, or used to be the mainstream, actually.
I mean, you talk at the beginning of the book how growing up in the San Fernando Valley, you watched all this, you watched the films of the, you know, the films of the time, which were kind of full of sex and violence, and you had a particular fondness for horror films. You think that kind of toughened you up?
Well, I think it's easy to make fun of someone for that. You're saying, I saw Carrie in 1976 and became a man because of it. Or it's the same thing, like, I walked to school for 6 blocks in the sunlight, and it really toughened me up. It's easy to make fun of that, I suppose. But I do think there is something about the notion that the world wasn't made for children then. And we really didn't have any options. I mean, our options were horror movies and movies made for adults. And whether they were Mel Brooks comedies or they were Nick Rogue films or whatever. I mean, that's what we did. The world wasn't made for children. And so me and my friends at 10, 11, 12 were seeing the movies that the adults were seeing. Mm. Adults took you to the movies and you saw whatever they wanted to see. And it was an education. And it was kind of peeking behind the curtain into adult life. And maybe maturing sooner than you would have if you grew up on Frozen and on Marvel movies and whatever. I mean, seeing how adults lived in real R-rated movies of the 70s, I don't know. It made you also want to be an adult. That's the other thing that's strange. It really it sped up the desire to get through school, get out of everything, and then enter into the world of adults. It wasn't scary. It was sort of sexy. It was enticing.
Although you grew up to become the author of American Psycho.
I did.
Maybe that's what people are worried about.
But I wonder, it's interesting. I do talk about that in the book about that horror movies were an aid in a way of making me see the failures of my family's life and the failures of the world and my own unhappiness. And they kind of helped me get through that in a way.
Yeah,
they told me that the world was, this is how the world was.
Yeah.
And it was oddly comforting.
So you talk a lot about millennials in the book. You're the boyfriend of one as well, so you're seeing this phenomenon up close.
24/7.
You call them Generation Wuss.
I used to call them that on my Twitter feed.
Right.
But as a joke.
But you say they've experienced kind of helicopter parents. They've often been medicated.
Oh, all of them have been medicated, yes.
Right. So you think they need to...
Oh, come on. I mean, the Twitter stuff started out as a joke. It was funny. I would list all these things that I noticed that should go under the headline of Generation Wuss. Like, I don't even remember most of them. But it stuck. It struck a nerve with people, and people thought, oh, that's such a Gen X term for millennials, Generation Wuss. And I played around with it for a couple of years. I never took it seriously, never pitched a book idea about it. But the title stuck. And when I was putting this book together, I had done a piece for Vanity Fair about living with a millennial and what it meant. Hugely sympathetic, as I am in the book too. There's a big paragraph that ends that talks about how sympathetic I am to them and also how they were not created in a vacuum. Another generation helped create them, and they are a reaction against that generation. Don't know if it's Gen X as much as maybe younger baby boomers. Maybe it's Gen X too. And I was talking about this with Chuck Palahniuk on my podcast 2 weeks ago. We were talking about, why wouldn't millennials be this way? Why wouldn't there be a reaction against the negativity, the nihilism, the aloofness and irony of Generation X? I mean, that's just the natural progression of things. And so what if they're aspirational to an almost ludicrous degree? I think so. But what's wrong with that, you know? And all the things that I complain about as a 55-year-old Gen Xer, and rightly so, I also temper with the fact that I understand where they're coming from. I completely understand it. And I am the old man on the porch, you know, shouting at whatever the clouds. But I also am deeply sympathetic to them as well. And I understand by living with one for 10 years and being in his shoes 24/7 and hearing him talk about his fears and his anxieties and why they're there. Sometimes I make fun of them. Sometimes I go, oh, thanks. I didn't get that.
Yeah.
And so it has become one of the more controversial aspects of this book, because people seem to think that I'm just slamming millennials when I'm really trying to understand them. And Generation Wuss is a fairly harmless moniker, I think. But it was interesting, the Sunday Times, I guess your rival, I don't know, Times, did this piece on me where the headline was, Brady Sinella said, what's going on with millennials? Millennials don't read anymore. I don't think they even read books. That's 20 seconds in a 2-hour interview I did with Decca. And that becomes the pull quote, that becomes the headline, and I am inundated with thousands of angry millennials on my Twitter feed. And of course, none of them wanted to go past the paywall to read the rest of the article to see what else I said about them. But I am very sympathetic to millennials and as well as frustrated by them and annoyed. You can be both.
You're kind of critical about the current drive to, you know, for instance, if you're doing a review of the Beyoncé album, it's, you know, if you're a black woman, you have a more authentic response to this record and a more penetrating critical reaction. Would you say that you're very against that kind of identity politics infused brand of criticism?
I'm not against it.
You're not against it?
That's fine. People can say whatever they want.
Because it's kind of the thing, isn't it? That
it's kind of boring, isn't it? I mean, it's a little groupthinky, isn't it?
It is a bit groupthinky, but I guess it does also say that, you know, people of my age and gender and demographic and yours as well, you know, maybe it's time we did budge up and give somebody else the microphone and again.
Yeah, right. Totally. Thumbs up. I agree. What can I say about that?
Yeah, you're not against that. But you're against kind of...
I'm not against... I think Beyoncé is at times... enough of a presence and a kind of major artist that I don't know if Beyoncé is quite the right example in terms of like representation or whatever the complaint might be in terms of what we're talking about in terms of. I don't know. I mean, you get in trouble, whatever. I mean, talking about this too much. I really don't care. You know, I don't really care that much about whether that is happening with Beyoncé. It did become a joke in the United States. Lemonade did become, in certain areas, it was raised to this kind of, you know, it ascended to, oh, you can't say anything about Lemonade and you can't say anything about negative about the Queen, even though, yeah, you could. There was negative things to say about Beyoncé. You see that documentary she made?
I mean, come on.
I mean, she's not, no one's foolproof, man.
Yeah.
But yet, there are certain places in the United States where it gets to be ludicrously touchy to criticize or say, hey, that's not a good song or that's not a good video without being tagged a sexist, racist asshole.
Yeah.
I think that's overreach.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit hysteric and that's kind of shutting down an opinion, which is something that I talk about a lot in White, where there does seem to be among millennials, I noticed, a need to shut down anything negative or anything that's too critical of their bubble, the world they live in. And there is an overreaction. My boyfriend does it all the time and I have to stop him. Right. You're overreacting to that. You shouldn't be that shamed by what they're saying about this about your YouTube thing.
Yeah.
You've got to, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
And yet he takes it extremely personally, extremely seriously. And he also talks over people and won't listen. And I see it again and again. And I try to, as you know, the older statesman of the house, try to bring him down a bit. And he's good at that. He acknowledges it now that he was like that. He wasn't listening and he was talking over people and that he should listen to other people's ideas because often he was not at all.
I'm interested in you. I can't really picture you in the role of calming someone down.
I can't either, and it happened. I didn't sign on for that. As I often told him early on in the relationship when I would see him having meltdowns, I said, this isn't what I signed on for. And then he would also get even more upset by that and even more triggered by my saying that.
Yeah.
But we have signed on for it, and it has been 10 years, and I don't see it not lasting. It's one of those things that just, you know, happened and worked. But yeah, I am the one who is in the role of being the person to calm someone down. I mean, White is by far the most controversial book that I've published since American Psycho. I don't know why, but whatever it is. And it's triggered a lot of people and it's gotten crazy tons of terrible press. But it has not gotten the amount of terrible press that American Psycho got. And I remember just a couple weeks ago after that New Yorker article appeared, where my editor, Gary Fiskejohn, and I were talking about, everyone was up in arms about the New Yorker, and there was all these other, this terrible book forum review by this transgender critic came out, and everyone was very upset, and the PR people were running around going, oh my God, what's going to happen? What are we doing? And Gary and Todd, my boyfriend, was extremely angry and upset about the responses this book was getting, and he even posted something, and then he got mob trolled. Gary and I were saying, God, you know, yeah, this is kind of controversial, but does anybody remember 1990 and 91 when the New York Times tried to cancel you when over 17 or 18 articles and they did two terrible book reviews and there was no one on your side and you were getting hundreds of death threats? Does anybody remember that there was no one there for you at all? And you kind of just, I just had to pretty much go through this trial by fire on my own. Mm. So, you know, that's one way of looking at everything that's happening right now.
And you say that writing that book was the happiest time of your life.
The aftermath was the happiest time of my life.
No, the writing of it, the summer of 91?
That was the summer after it was published, spring of 91. And it was all over. The book came out, and it was just a book. And to many people, a very boring book. And if I have said this, if there was a Rotten Tomatoes for books, it would have had a zero. I got no good reviews, all horrible reviews across the board in the States, except there was one. Henry Bean in the Los Angeles Times gave it a good review. And I think 10,000 people unsubscribed to the LA Times because of that. You know, triggering people. If you want to trigger someone, could you trigger them?
Me?
Anybody. Could you trigger someone if you wanted to trigger them? I don't know if you could trigger me. I really don't know what I could be triggered by.
Right.
What could it be at 55? I don't know. Yeah. Or 45. I never got
pissed off by things, though. You say that.
Mildly pissed off. And I do write this opening kind of ominous prologue to the piece where I talked about going online. And I found myself experiencing emotions that I never experienced before, that I was getting angry about stuff. And I really had to pull back on because I never experienced this before. And that I was finding myself getting super annoyed, overly annoyed by people's opinions about stuff that seemed so hysteric, so over the top, that it activated something in me. And then I became momentarily hysteric, and it was this kind of loop that was playing out that I didn't want to be a part of. And so there was that moment, and I talk about it before. I think the book goes into a section where I talk about why I haven't been writing novels, where that was happening, and it was unpleasant.
So obviously loads of people, including your boyfriend, are enraged by Trump. So do you feel calm and level-headed about the political climate in America?
Well, I am certainly not a Trump apologist. I'm not voted for Trump. I am not conservative. I'm not a Republican. I'm none of those things. But yet, if you do not adamantly come out against Trump, and I believe he was just elected president. Yeah. He was elected president. What can you do about it? I told this to my boyfriend. I said, he was elected president. You know, ignore him. Ignore him and start thinking about policy and start thinking about maybe ways to like get him to do stuff like Kim Kardashian did, you know, and kind of see if you, I mean, even Leonardo DiCaprio went and saw him after he got elected to like say, look, I've got this, my global green thing, and I want to make sure that this is protected and blah, 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 whatever the conversation was. And I think that was the best way to handle him. I do not think how he was handled over the past 3 years was helpful to anybody. I don't think the resistance was helpful to anything. And I think putting all of your hope in either Stormy Daniels or Michael Avenatti or the Mueller report was a bad move. And I don't know if it wasted enough time. I don't know if it helped fracture everything. But I have no skin in the game. I'm not rolling for Donald Trump. Yes. I want my boyfriend to be happy. But I do think that when I'm complaining, and there's a section in the book where I'm talking about the usual cast of characters from my novels, the entitled. And I'm not talking about people in poverty. I'm not talking about marginalized people. I'm not talking about people of color or people who do have super terrible problems in parts of the United States. It is about white entitled people losing their shit over an election in Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And that's what that section is about. Yeah. And that has gotten a lot of people irate, and they don't like that section. But it is by no means people who might directly be affected by policies that the Trump administration put out. I don't like the policies. I don't like the Muslim ban. I don't like the trans shit that's going on, to just name two things. Yeah. But it is if you are not an adamant hater, then somehow you're colluding with them. And that is where I've gotten stuck. And I see people make comments about me who haven't read the book or think I'm just some kind of – I become some kind of like Rush Limbaugh – you know, right-wing nutbag. And you can talk to Todd and he can tell you that that is anything but the truth. But I'm also not virtue signaling here. I'm obviously a man of a certain demo. And I think I was at one time, well, liberalish, progressive certainly, as someone growing up gay in the 80s and in the 90s, you kind of had to be. You really weren't, you wanted some kind of equality, and it was hard to reprocess the world all the time without, And also with AIDS looming everywhere. And so I always thought, but I do see that you get a bit more cynical as you get older, and you do see the world in a more jaundiced way, and you're simply not as aspirational or young as Todd is. And that's great to be young, and it's great to be that aspirational. You can also hit the wall a couple of times, which he probably will do, and you'll pick yourself up and dust yourself off, and you'll move on to the next thing.
So, Sean, I mean, really interestingly nuanced his opinions are, but are they a little bit disingenuous too?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the funny thing, that I think there is a distinction between Bret Easton Ellis the person and Bret Easton Ellis the writer, and I don't think much of his writing has much nuance in it. Certainly in this book, White, I don't think many of his essays show much sort of appreciation for shades of grey. It's sort of just, this is what I think about the world and this is how it is. I was surprised by the quality of his arts criticism, though. I actually really enjoyed those parts of the book. But that's the funny thing. That's not what anyone has been talking about over the last few weeks. It's always been Trump and the left and young people. And I do think he has a point to be made about whether some people on the left are just sort of completely unable to take criticism. And so if you do criticize anything that they identify in themselves, then they immediately say, okay, well, then you're the other, you're the right wing, you're a Trump supporter. But that is the thing to remember about him, that he's always shown quite an ability to be very socially liberal. And he did live through the AIDS era, and he is a gay man, and he has usually voted Democrat, he said in the interview, and didn't vote for Trump. But there is this idea that I think he therefore thinks that's unfair that he's been lumped into that group. But I would say he's done very little to actually demonstrate that publicly, that he isn't all of those things that people are criticizing him of.
He is part of a tradition of writers who sort of, they think that they're accidental controversialists, but actually it's almost like they're hardwired to be controversial, isn't it?
Well,
so writers like, well, I'm thinking of Martin Amis or Lionel Shriver.
Yeah.
Martin Amis saying that, suggesting that euthanasia booths should be set up on street corners to deal with the silver tsunami of unwanted old people, or conflating Islam with terrorism. Or on the other hand, Lionel Shriver attacking a publisher for being drunk on virtue, for trying to introduce policies to broaden their stuffing.
I was looking at the cover of the Spectator this week actually, and she's raging about how feminists don't know how good they've got it. There is a trait that I see both in Shriver and I see also in Bret Easton Ellis, is this affected outrage at outrage culture, and this idea that because people disagree with you, therefore there is some sort of irrationality involved in that, and that if people are criticizing you, it's censorship, which I just completely believe isn't true. And so when he was being interviewed by Alex, the reactions he was getting from people. He kept bringing up the reactions he was getting from people, but he was also saying that he wasn't that bothered, and he's sort of trying to affect being disaffected by things, and it's just so blatantly not true. You can tell that he's bothered that people don't like. And even in the essays, he writes about sort of sweating and swearing over his keyboard as he deals with people on Twitter, and it's just like, you do clearly care about what people think of you. So why are you so set upon trying to pretend you don't?
But you could call it the what me culture.
Yeah, exactly. I've said a shocking thing and oh my god, everyone's shocked.
But it's almost like there's a commercial impact to it as well, isn't it? It's a recognized ploy for gaining attention, getting readers, selling books.
Well, I did sort of wonder about having him on the show, to be honest. I know that he's a very significant writer and he's got a career, but that sort of pattern of attention seeking that was happening in all the interviews in the lead up, and there was really barely anything about all of the really sort of quite interesting ideas he's tackling in the book, it did actually make me wonder, like, should we have him on? And I'm sort of glad that maybe that interview did convey some of the things he actually has to say, as opposed to all the noise around him.
And one of the things about these controversial, these what me writers, as I'm now henceforward going to call them, is that the controversialism is outside of their body of work, isn't it? With Amis or Shriver, actually, it's the things they say in the room when they're promoting. It's not the same as Germaine Greer, who is, her whole work is a polemical. She is a polemicist.
Yeah.
Which makes it seem all the more like a kind of media strategy rather than actually a vital part of their project.
Yeah, maybe we just say they're hardwired for success, and part of success in this media world means you have to generate headlines, and that's the way it's taken them, which you could say is very cynical, but you could also say it's smart.
Yeah. Well done, Brett.
Well, anyway, one job where controversialism is definitely not welcome is that of Poet Laureate. We'll be chatting about that after the break.
It's time to focus.
The mood in the UK right now, it seems to me, is a huge set of tensions and contradictions and emotions and feelings about our past, and we're not thinking very much about the future.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Well, it's been steeped in all the secrecy of the Vatican City, but at last the white smoke has billowed from the chimneys of Downing Street, which is to say that finally, and not before time, we know who the next Poet Laureate will be. It's Simon Armitage. Cues for great cheers in this room.
Fireworks! Party poppers!
Since not everyone will be versed in the arcane traditions of the English literary establishment, Sian, because you're an Australian.
You're Australian.
You've had to do a quick self-education course, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, well, I find it really interesting. It's one of those sort of pomp and ceremony things that I find slightly charming about you Brits, but it's
our best features.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of archaic sounding roles, which is, it's admirable in its own way that it's still going. So there is some excitement every time a new one comes along. But yeah, it's been a role since 1668, so we've basically got 300 to 400 years of poet laureates. And the first laureate was John Dryden. It used to be for life, but it is now only 10 years. I do believe Tennyson was the longest laureate. I think he did it for 42 years until he died.
God, couldn't get rid of him.
I know.
couldn't even get him to drink himself to death on all that sack.
Oh, yeah. So that's another charming thing. So you always got a little stipend. And I think Dryden got 200 quid a year, basically, to be laureate. Now it's £5,750 a year. And then you get 720 bottles of sherry,
which is sack, and yeah, they're called butts of sack.
Sounds wrong. And it used to be an annual bottle of sherry, so you just got a sherry every year that you did the job, but now it's just a weird tradition. You get 720. I don't know why, but that's nice. Carol Ann Duffy, who is the outgoing laureate, she was our first ever woman laureate.
It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it, when you think people like Christina Rossetti or Elizabeth Barrett Browning or any number of 20th century poets.
So Elizabeth Barrett Browning was actually considered in 1850 when Wordsworth died, but then Tennyson was chosen instead. And then when Tennyson died, selectors had the option to get Rossetti as the successor, but then they decided not to fill the position rather than appoint a woman, which sounds very reasonable and not at all wrong. And then Alfred Austin eventually took the role, and I was giggling all morning reading about Alfred Austin because it just seems like everyone hated him and all the poets that were working at the time absolutely hated him. And Robert Browning referred to him as the Banjo Byron, which I love.
Oh, there was a wonderful put down by, I think it was by Alexander Pope, of Colley Cibber, who is one of the early incumbents. And he said, one whose poetry is so sublimely bad, it is not poetry, but prose run mad.
Very good. It's even better when you put down rhymes. So yeah, it's one of those weird things where basically there is no job description, but you're just sort of expected to produce poetry for momentous national occasions. So, for example, Tennyson wrote The Charge of the Light Brigade during the Crimean War, but you also get, you know, royal baby poems, you get...
It's now all about royal baby poems. Yeah. or wedding poems, which actually have a formal name in English poetry, which is the epithalamium.
That's a very good word. We should use that more. I don't know how we're going to get that in the conversation, but we should all use it.
Epithalamia from Simon Armitage. Richard, was this a bit of a disappointment in a way? I mean, there were so the names that were in the frame included Jackie Kay, Imtiaz Darka,
and Daljit Nagra. Well.
And there was a feeling, or at least in our office, but I mean, we do go around in ever decreasing, so we do sort of discuss things among ourselves a lot, that there was an effort being made to cast the net outside that what one could describe Parche, Simon Armitage, pale, male and stale.
I mean, it's not, I think he'll do the job extremely well. I mean, he's been doing great things as Oxford Professor of Poetry, and he's, again, he's hardly a kind of public school educated kind of one of the clubbable old gents, is he? But they do seem to have opted for a very safe candidate. It's disappointing, I suppose, maybe only in as much as it demonstrates just how hard it is to find someone of his experience, his kind of capacities, who isn't one of that kind of crowd.
Who would you have preferred to have seen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that if Imtiaz Darka had felt able to do it, I think she would have been great. And there's also John Agard, who was very positive about the idea at the end of last year. And I think would have been a very, very different kind of candidate, would have taken a very different kind of energy to it.
Yeah, there were all these names like Lem Sisse being mentioned and Daljit, like you mentioned before, and Jackie Kay, Alice Oswald.
Well, Jackie Kay is Scottish Macar, so that would have been a bit
she
controversial.
She basically ruled herself out and said she didn't think that she could do
both. Could be both.
And then Alice Oswald, at the moment, there's the vote going on at the moment for the Oxford Professor of Poetry, which Simon Armitage is leaving, and it looks like Alice Oswald, she's one of two contenders for that role going up against Andrew McMillan. So it looked like when she became a confirmed contender for that role, it looked like it was her sort of removing herself from contention for Laureate and showing her interest in that role instead. But someone like Lem Sisse, who's just got such an amazing stage presence, would be so good for a role, which is kind of now more about public engagement, really, with poetry than sort of sitting away in a room and writing something.
But at this point, I want to defend Simon Armitage, because I think at this moment in history, when the country is so embattled, actually what he embodies, his body of work represents is a sort of sighting of the national identity in the north of England, particularly in Yorkshire, but also the way he has rethought the meaning of things like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and the poem Middle English. He talked about Gawain and the Green Knight as being written by a northerner or perhaps a Midlander. He said the linguistic epicentre of the poem has been located in the area of Cheshire, Staffordshire, Derbyshire border. So there's something about him, about he's not a metropolitan elite sort of writer, and he's absolutely, that is what his career is based on.
It must be said, like, people have laid into him a bit, and someone put it really well, that it's sort of the idea that because it's simple, it's bad, and that's so entirely wrong, that he is tackling really big ideas, but he's just trying to make them as accessible as possible, and he shouldn't be derided for doing that.
And also a great public performer as well, and engage with great public projects like his Stanza Stones across the north of England. So I mean, very much somebody who can fulfil that part of the job as well.
And the Stanza Stones, interestingly, because that's claiming Yorkshire and laying down in the stones of Yorkshire poetry, which is sort of a fantastic project when you think how marginalised poetry is. And it's, for people who don't know about it, it's a 50-mile walk along which there are 6 milestones, into which each of which is carved a Simon Armitage water poem. So it's about landscape and the experiencing of nature, the experiencing of the north of England, which seems to me a fantastic reframing of what it is to be patriotic, what it is to belong to a place and to love a place, and for poetry to be part of that. He came onto the podcast a little while ago when that was published to talk about them. So let's just end with a couple of his water poems from the Stanza Stone Trail.
I'd like to read this poem, Rain. This is carved at a place called Cow's Mouth Quarry, which is actually on the Pennine Way and looks down onto this most incredible, expansive view. There's the whole Bay of Greater Manchester in front of you on a clear day, and then you can see right to the Welsh Hills and Jodrell Bank, and you can see up to Winter Hill in Bolton, and you can see a bit of the Lake District, and you can see, you know, you keep looking west. So this stone where the poem is carved is really the first place that those great depressions barreling in off the Atlantic smash against. Rain. Be glad of these freshwater tears. Each pearled droplet, some salty old sea bullet, airlifted out of the waves, then laundered and sieved, recast as a soft bead and returned. And no matter how much it strafes or sheets, it is no mean feat to catch one raindrop clean in the mouth, to take one drop on the tongue, tasting cloud pollen, grain of the heavens, raw sky. Let it teem up here where the front of the mind distills the brunt of the world. Mist. Who does it mourn? What does it mean, such nearness, gathering here on high ground while your back was turned, drawing its net curtains around? Featureless silver screen, mist is water in its ghost state, all inwardness, holding its milky breath, veiling the pulsing machines of great cities under your feet, walling you into these moments, into this anti-garden of gritstone and peat. Given time, the edge of your being will seep into its fibreless fur. You are lost, adrift in hung water and blurred air. But you are here.
Simon Armitage there, and long may he reign. Reign in both senses of the word, and for 10 years anyway. Bret Easton Ellis's White is published by Picador and is out now. For more information on the Stanza Stones walk, go to www.stanzastones.co.uk. And we've pretty much resolved to have an office outing, haven't we? All 55 miles
road
of it.
Trip, road trip.
Next week, we take a look at graphic novels through the unexpected eyes of Andrea Wolfe and her book about Alexander von Humboldt, the naturalist.
And as always, do contact us on Twitter at Guardian Books or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. And do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Sian Kane.
And me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.